Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. This is a podcast with the unpopular opinion that progressive politics has a lot to offer the modern world. I'm your host, Hannah Shah, and today I'm joined by Steph Lloyd to discuss just what the f*** is going on. And to tee you up even more in the second half of this episode, and to coincide with today's climate march, we have Stefan's interview with Alice Bell from 1010 UK on how to communicate the fact that, chlorinated chicken or not, we're all screwed if we don't act now on the ecological crisis facing our planet. Now, I don't know about you, Steph, but it seems like we're stuck in a series of repetitive and painful events. Not unlike the Saw films, it feels like we've had various politicians choosing to chop bits of themselves off as part of a tortured and messy game that's making us all cringe.
I really enjoy the drawn-out Saw metaphor of which you did there. For people that don't know, there are a series of really vile horror films. And there was a wonderful discussion in the office earlier where Heather was like, guys, name me a really bad trilogy of films. And what we've discovered is, even the trilogies that did exist have almost all been extended because apparently nobody has any original ideas anymore.
Pretty much, yeah.
But however, I mean, the fun fact is that I actually spent all of Christmas watching the Saw films because that felt like a really nice break from politics, which I think says it all.
I definitely watched a lot of them as a child because my dad quite likes watching them. And I'm not sure whether that had a psychological effect on me or not, but hey, we'll find out.
Sinister, that.
Very sinister. I think that says it all. So, I mean, we've had meaningful votes 1 and 2. And to me, it seems like we haven't really got anywhere, or have we?
Well, we have and we haven't in exactly the same way. So nothing has changed and everything has changed. But yeah, so we had meaningful vote part 2 this
week.
The sequel, yeah. We might get a bad trilogy. That might be a thing that occurs, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. So obviously this week was when the meaningful vote went back to Parliament. Mm-hmm. So that took place on Tuesday night and it was resoundingly defeated again. So they had brought some people over onto their side. We did a sweepstake in the office, of which I won, in terms of how much we thought it would fall by. But it was still it is still an unbelievably substantial defeat of which she had faced in terms of her deal. We then move forward to last night, which basically became a circus in every sense of the word. So basically the sequence of events and how it was going to work, we were always going to have the meaningful vote part 2 on her deal just in and as it was. Mm-hmm. And there were no amendments that were put forward to that. It was a straight vote on the deal. Do we want it? Yes or no? Everybody resoundingly voted no. Then we moved on to last night of do we want no deal? And it was that idea that obviously Labour have been very strongly pushing that at no point should we have a deal. The ERG on the Conservative side think that we should definitely have a deal. We should definitely have no deal and that'd be great because they're already rich. So it doesn't matter if they don't stockpile their food. And so that came down and there were a remarkable amount of, I feel like shenanigans is the best way of which to describe
that's
this.
That's a good word. I like the word shenanigans.
And, you know, there's some real detail in terms of, you know, the government ended up whipping against their own motion, half of the cabinet, and then didn't even barely vote with the motion, and the government whip. So Caroline Spelman, who was the MP that had put forward basically what happened last night, and the crux of the issue was you had the motion put forward by the government, which was, well, we'll have no deal. We'll say that we don't want a deal, but the legal default is still that we will go and leave without a deal unless some form of deal is passed through before the 29th of March. There was then an amendment put down by Caroline Spelman and various other people within the House that said, no, at no point do we want to have no deal. So this is not just about in between now and the 29th of March. This is at no point ever do we want there to not be a deal. Now, the interesting thing about this is a couple of things. One is this wasn't binding. So this wasn't like the meaningful vote. This was an indicative vote, but it wasn't meaningful in that sense as it didn't change legislation.
Yeah.
The second part of it was that Caroline Spelman basically caved in and tried to withdraw her amendment after it had been selected. Now, once it's been selected, it's then the property of the House. It's not the property of her. So hero of the hour, Yvette Cooper, stands up to move the motion, and that motion passes narrowly, only by about 4 votes, but it passes. Now, this means that the House has said at no point does it want no deal. Because that motion had then been changed, the government then whipped against that motion, which was that they wanted. So bearing in mind, Philip Hammond had stood up that day for the spring statement and said no deal would be disastrous for this country.
Yeah.
The government then whipped to still keep no deal as an option on the table, which also fell.
And just on that note, if you haven't seen it already, Alison McGovern recorded a great video basically explaining about the spring statement and why it's a thing and why austerity is bad. You should definitely all watch it. It's on Twitter.
Yeah. So we've then got more votes today.
Yeah.
So obviously we're recording the podcast on Thursday. You'll be listening tomorrow morning. Literally, who knows what is going to happen? And anybody who says they do is lying. They do not know. We then now have a vote today on whether or not we should extend Article 50. So Article 50 is obviously the bit of legislation.
Yeah.
And we are meant to leave in accordance to Article 50 on the 29th of March. And there are 4 amendments that have been put down for that.
Yes, there are. And they are one of the people's vote.
Yeah. Yeah, so the first one of those is, there's lots of various different, you know, so this is Amendment H. So basically it's by the Independent Group and a few other people, which basically says we should have an extension to Article 50 and the purpose for that should be a people's vote. Mm. You've then got the second one, which is Amendment I, which is basically by Hilary Benn, Oliver Letwin.
And Yvette Cooper again.
And Yvette Cooper, the hero of the
high five for Yvette.
And this is all basically saying there should be an extension. However, this should be, so there's a series of indicative votes. What we've not had at any point, the government keeps saying, well, you can't vote for something. You have to vote for, you can't vote against something. You have to vote for something.
Yeah.
They're not actually really giving people the opportunity to do that. So this is about a series of indicative votes that would happen next week in Parliament and that the government would have to make time for those votes to happen. You've then got the third, which is the Labour front bench amendment. So that is about having an extension and it's about being able to find a majority within the House that would likely be pushing for their deal rather than Theresa May's deal. And then you've got Amendment J, which basically says, because rumour has it that, you know, Theresa May is going to do a meaningful vote 3 next week, which would make it part of a wonderful trilogy. Basically Amendment J says one of the rules, so we don't have like a written constitution, we have a codified constitution. And part of that basically means there's a very big book by Erskine May, which states the kind of rules of Parliament.
Yeah, but what's historically happened, right?
And part of that is basically the government cannot just keep putting down the same motions if nothing has changed, which is what they keep trying to do. So Jay is the wonderful Alison McGovern, who is obviously a hero of this podcast, is one of the signatories on that. And it basically says you cannot keep just trying to force this vote through. It is against the way that we do things as the House. And like, you've lost it twice now. It's gone. It's dead.
Yeah.
Forget about it. So who knows where we're going to quite end up on that.
And I think really quickly, just to jump back to E and the Labour front bench amendment.
Yeah.
I think what is a really interesting part about that is obviously it essentially says we should have an extension, but it's clear that May's withdrawal agreement hasn't been successful. Mm-hmm. So we have to negotiate our own.
Yes.
Chances of us like having a general election and then negotiating our own withdrawal agreement?
I mean, who knows? I mean, firstly, yeah, for us to be able to do that, we would have to be in government. That still feels, I mean, it doesn't feel quite as far away as it has done previously.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we'll go on to talk about the kind of events of last night and what that means for Theresa May as a government in a little moment. But yeah, they would have to do that. I mean, their vote, they have already put their plan to Parliament a number of times and that they have lost that on those occasions. Now, granted, it is significantly less than the government has lost theirs, but they have still lost that. So there is no real kind of clear way through in terms of that. I think kind of far more likely would be something around the indicative votes as to giving some form of consensus or way through this. I think it is interesting that they've put down a people's vote motion. It's obviously what I think is probably going to be the best way out in terms of either a people's vote or some form of confirmation vote in terms of that and going back to the people. Whether now is the right time to do that, I don't think is necessarily true. Mm. But we will see what happens. I think the important thing to think about with this, though, is if that does fall, I don't think that is necessarily... it's certainly not the end of a people's vote in terms of how that works, or some form of confirmatory vote in terms of going back to the people. Lots of people will try and jump all over that and say that is the case. But there are lots of people who say, I want to get through a sequence of events.
Yeah.
If there is, if we can't get through that, then I would move to that position. And so it's still all on the table in terms of that.
Yeah. And I mean, in exactly the same way that on Wednesday night, the House said, they wanted no deal. Mm. In the same way, if this amendment falls, it's not binding in any way. It just says right now, the House doesn't necessarily think a public vote is the best way forward. Mm. That doesn't necessarily mean that they can't change their minds. Mm. It is obviously the sort of preface of this entire conversation that we're having. I want to move on quickly to talk about how what we saw on Wednesday night basically shows how fundamentally weak Theresa May is. So as you said, the Tories ended up whipping against themselves in this sort of bizarre thing where the amendment passed and then Theresa May went, oh God, now we can't let the motion that we put forward pass, so we'll have to whip against it. And they still lost. The government were voting against themselves and they still lost. So she can't really even seem to get people to disagree with her anymore, which I think is phenomenal. Mm. What do you think the events of Wednesday night tell us about May as a prime minister?
I think it's abundantly clear that her prime ministership in one way or another is now over. And I think she now knows that probably for the first time in terms of how that is. I think she will cling on to try and get whatever she can through over the next couple of months. But beyond that, I can't imagine a situation where she doesn't leave at some point. I think, you know, it was even the optics of it, bless her, with her kind of comedy cough that went through and how painful. I mean, you could hear the pain in her voice, right? And I have a level of sympathy because anybody who knows me will know the sheer level of like angst that I get in my voice and the pain I get if we do big conferences or anything else. Gets very painful. I have a lot of sympathy for that. But the metaphor of which she was stood there and she could barely even get a word out, I think really just is the most symbolic kind of picture that we can have of just how dead this government is. The idea that you can be a government minister and vote against your own government and your own motions and your own plan shows that basically right now we don't really have a government.
Yeah, I think Anna Turley, fantastic Labour MP, tweeted about saying to the whips that she had a soothers and the whips going, oh no, don't worry, it'll all be fine, everything is fine, nothing's changed. But joke aside though, obviously as you mentioned, so a couple of high profile people within the government and indeed within the cabinet, so for example, Amber Rudd, of recent Coloured People fame, chose to abstain on the motion. And obviously we have a thing in this country, or we used to, as part of our unwritten constitution called collective responsibility. The idea that the government or the cabinet makes decisions as a group and they all back the prime minister up. And then if one of them disagrees with the course of action the prime minister has chosen, they're sort of morally and politically required to resign. Now, it seems like Amber Rudd is still in her job, even though she fundamentally disagrees, it seems, with May's course of action. Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly honest, we've just got incompetence coming out of our ears now. Like the fact we have Chris Grayling and Karen Bradley holding on, despite being utter failures of ministers, is surely a case to say that the government's basically done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is any.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The way out of the situation they have now got themselves into, I think the thing that is even more scary in one sense is, I mean, you look at the sheer level of incompetence, as you say, a total lack of collective responsibility as a government. They can't get anything through in terms of what they want to do. And yet still they are the ones in power. And when you look at the polls, they are still the ones that people trust the most.
It's ridiculous.
Which for me is the most terrifying thing. But also, you know, if the Labour leadership, hardly their biggest fan, but if they are not able to look at that and see there is a serious problem, I would be genuinely worried. And honestly, I think if people like Keir Starmer were not there, and the real talent that we see on the backbenches of the Labour Party, and people like Alison, Peter Carl, and Phil Wilson, and Pat McGovern, and Hilary Benn, and Yvette Cooper, who have been, you know, constantly trying to make this work, if they were not there, I dread to think just how bad a state we would be in, because they are the kind of grown-ups in the room that have the ability to take this forward.
Yeah.
And they are not putting their head in the sand, and they are making very difficult decisions in order to get the best for this country going forwards. But yeah, I mean, the idea that someone as senior in the Conservative Party as Amber Rudd can do that and still be in government is truly remarkable. But it does make a slight step change from not having a racist gaffe this week in terms of Amber Rudd.
There's a little
theme song that we sing in the office about it, but that's for another day.
So last thing, looking forward to MV3, the final chapter, we hope, touch wood, maybe not. What can we expect? Like, I know Westminster pundits are sort of currently more Professor Trelawney than like Nostradamus, but looking into your tea leaves, Steph, can you ever go?
I think that's about the most accurate response I think I could ever give. I honestly don't know what will happen, because particularly with things like the amendment tonight where it blocks MV3 next week, we're really going to have to see where that lands.
Yeah.
But there is going to, I think what might be most likely is the idea that we get into a situation where we can have some form of, there will be an extension and we have some form of indicative votes just to see anything that can be kind of scrambled together for some form of majority. So I think that is probably what's going to be the most likely outcome of this, and it's probably going to be the best outcome for the country. We then have to look at, once we've got that idea of what could give a way forward, mm-hmm. of being able to take that back for some form of confirmatory vote to the people.
Fingers crossed. Okay, let's leave it there. And go back to, I know, trying to stop Brexit or panicking or whatever it is we do at the moment. On that cheery note, we're going to take a quick break. Now, just before we hear from Stefan, speak to Alice Bell from 1010 UK about how to avoid climate catastrophe, which is obviously looming, Just a reminder that if you enjoy this podcast, please share it. Share it with your friends, colleagues, milkmen, lollipop ladies, frenemies, you know, Instagram mates, whatever. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, review.
Our planet is dying, not in 10, 50 or 100 years, but as we speak. Right now, as you're listening to this podcast, we are doing irreversible damage to our planet that future generations will have to pay for. Are you scared yet? If you're struggling to feel the fear, you're not alone. One of the biggest hurdles to saving our planet is connecting the academic facts about climate change with its real devastating consequences. And on that cheery note, today I'm speaking to Alice Bell, co-director of 1010 Climate Action, to talk about how we can shift the political and policy consensus to a place where we can address this unprecedented national emergency. So to kick us off, could you give us a sense of how far we are from where we need to be on climate action?
I'm going to start with a positive.
Okay.
And that in terms of where we need to be, in terms of having the tools to be able to tackle it, I think we're doing all right. There are some things that still need a fair bit of technological development. One of the ways in which we are, I'm getting onto the negative already. One of the ways in which we're far behind is that we need to invest a lot more in R&D in particular areas, things like battery storage, heat. Decarbonising heat is one of the big challenges, particularly in the UK. And if we're going to do this in a way that isn't going to continue to burn a lot of fossil fuels, but also isn't going to leave people literally out in the cold, and that will also mean, I mean, let's be blunt, dying, then we need to put a lot more money into thinking about hydrogen, how we can have more efficient things like heat pumps and the electrification of heat. But I'm going to go back to the positives. I mean, there are some very basic things that we know we can do. We're just not doing it yet. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm going back to negative. We're not doing it. And so I guess where the biggest gap is in terms of political will. And attached to that, I think public engagement and public, it's not that the public aren't aware, especially in the UK, climate skepticism is still very much a niche hobby. We're in Tufton Street, Global Warming Policy Foundation are just down the road, but still they are unusual. That is an unusual position to take. You might not think it looking at some of the editorials in some of the newspapers, but if you survey the UK public generally, they believe climate change is happening. They believe that humans are causing it, and they believe that we need to take action. It's just when you ask them what they're most worried about, or the thing that's at the front of their mind when they're doing their shopping or voting or angry at the newspapers or whatever, it's not climate change. And I mean, that I think is where we're really far behind on.
Yeah. And I think, and so I want to ask you about something about going from that knowing to the kind of knowing the devastating consequences of climate change to feeling it. And one example I have of this, which is completely far removed and slightly ridiculous, is walking through the streets of London with one of my friends. We remarked on the amount of dog mess there was on the street and kind of how disruptive it was and how annoying it was and how much it could ruin your day if you were to step in it. And my friend reflected that this was actually a consequence of cuts to local government. And if our local government was funded properly, we'd have less mess on the streets. And in that moment, there's this kind of visceral feeling and a strong connection between that kind of academic policy stuff that I knew about, and I knew kind of how bad austerity was and how much it was ruining people's lives, and then this almost banal interaction with dog mess on the street suddenly kind of made it a lot more real. So without calling it kind of the dog poo problem, which I don't want to coin as a phrase, how do we get people to wake up and see the consequences of climate change in their day-to-day lives in a way that's much more serious, obviously?
Well, that is one of the big challenges of climate change, one of the big challenges of climate comms. And it's one of the reasons why I used to work in science communication generally for many years, and I shifted to be specifically in climate stuff. It's partly because I'm really scared. I've got a colleague who says, once you start looking at climate change, you can't really look away. And I got that problem. But it's also, that is actually really interesting, and it's a massive challenge. It's I think, so much more challenging than a lot of other social and political issues, as well as science communication issues. There isn't a dog mess equivalent. Mm. There are other sort of proxies for that. I mean, there is flooding. There was the weird heat wave we had recently. And what's different in the last few years is people are making the connections between that and climate change more confidently, mm-hmm. and more quickly. And more people are doing that. I mean, that's another positive in terms of how far we are away. We do know that this is happening, and it isn't obvious. It's one of the things that I find gives me hope about climate change is that really climate change is not obvious. You need a lot of quite specialist and diverse, multidisciplinary, complicated scientific research to see it. And yet us humans, you know, we are clever and stupid enough to have got ourselves into this mess, but we're also clever enough to have actually spotted it. And we spotted it like quite a long time ago, which is also depressing that we haven't done anything about it, but, or we haven't done enough about it, but, you know, we have the science there to warn us. It's just getting everyone to see that on an everyday level, because the ways in which scientists have pieced this together to be able to see it are dazzlingly, beautifully, inspiringly complicated. Mm. And so most of us don't see it. I think it is about talking about climate change when we talk about the weather. Climate and weather are different, but that doesn't mean that they can't be part of the same conversation. It's about having a lot more global news and being aware of a lot more global agendas. You know, we can be very parochial in the UK, like most countries, but particularly the UK. You know, we only really care about what happens. I mean, I think too much of our media only really cares about what happens in Westminster, let alone the whole of the country, let alone the whole of the world. But there are ways in which climate change is more and more obvious in other parts of the world. In some ways in the UK, we get off a bit lightly. And I think a more global conversation, I think part of the reason why younger people are more attuned to climate change issues is partly because they have more of a stake in more of the future than older people. And it's also because they've always grown up with it. Like, I mean, you don't have to be even that young to have always grown up with fear of climate change, but certainly people who are in their teens and their 20s now, it's like not only did they all grow up with it, but so did their teachers. So it's not so new. But I think it's also that they are more connected internationally. And they have, you look at the climate strikers at the moment, and you can see, like, if you follow them on Twitter, you can see the UK ones retweeting the Ugandan one, the Nigerian one, and the American ones. And they're all having this amazing international conversation. And I think that is one of the things that we need to do in order for all of us to be a little bit more aware of it.
And having that conversation right now with Brexit going on, it seems to be taking up so much of the national conversation. And I just wonder, in terms of the broader goals of that progressive movement, where does climate change fit into that? Is there a sense in which climate change can address some of the underlying causes of the vote to leave the European Union in a way that can kind of insert itself into the national conversation?
I think it'll aggravate it. I think one of the depressing things and one of the reasons why so many people should be concerned about climate change is that it will make everything else we want to do harder. So if you care about social issues, if you care about gender issues, if you care about economic inequality, if you care about racism, you need to care about climate change. And all the other things that we want to sort will be made harder because of climate change. So I guess that, I mean, I'm sorry to bring it back to a downer, but I think that is how climate change will insert itself. And the way in which Brexit is inserting itself into the climate change debate is it's a massive distraction. It's become almost banal to say this because people keep repeating it, but it's true, which is we should be spending now, this year, 2019 should be the massive year of climate action. I mean, 2009 should have been, 1999 should have been, but 2019 really, really should be. It should not be about talking about Brexit. Mm. And actually Britain did a lot of brilliant things on international climate action through the EU. People think a lot of the stories were spun as environmental rules were pushed on Britain by the EU, but actually Britain was a big advocate for climate action in the EU. And so that's another thing that's sort of a bit worrying about us moving out of it. Although I think there are other actors in the EU that have taken up that role.
Okay, and looking across the Atlantic, people who follow American politics will see a lot of chat at the moment about the Green New Deal. I guess, could you start by giving us a summary of what you understand as the Green New Deal when it's talked about in America?
In America? Well, I mean, there's two threads to it. One of the things that's quite exciting about it is the way that they are managing to connect environmental issues, particularly climate change, to other social and political issues, and talk about what in the UK we sometimes call a just transition. So there's been a few people writing about it recently, talking about it as environmentalism with Trumpian characteristics. There's been a couple of different writers in the States slightly trolling the environmentalist movement by saying that. But there are ways in which they're talking about industrial policy, which I don't think it's particularly fair to call it Trumpian. And also, I don't think we should call that approach to industrial policy. He doesn't own it. Mm-hmm. But it's the fact that it's talking about economic issues and it's talking about jobs and it's talking about industrial policy in a way that actually most environmental policymakers have always been. But when you get a lot of the green rhetoric, it sometimes falls apart. And certainly people who aren't part of the green movement, often their perception of the green movement is it's about hugging trees. It's not about British jobs or American jobs. So they're shifting the debate around environment to be a lot more about that. They're putting racial equality at the core of it as well. and talking about racial inequality around that. I mean, bits of it are, it slightly depends on which bit of the Green New Deal conversation you're having. But the other really important thing is it's a public debate, and it's a debate that's involving lots of different groups. So it came from this group called the Sunrise Movement. And we've seen news recently about young people protesting politicians and then being told to go away. And that's part and parcel of the fact that it's people coming to their political representatives and pushing it that way. So in some ways, it is a very much grassroots movement rather than what we have seen with some forms of environmental policy discussions before, which have been quite top down. And what some way of thinking about environmental policy making is that it's very top down. It comes from the UN talk to the EU, and then the EU talk to the member states, and the member states talk to the to their constituents. And it, I mean, often that's not how it works at all. It's much more complicated like that, like any form of policy making. But the Green New Deal is very explicitly turning that kind of top down approach on its head. And that's interesting, I think, for everyone around the world to be looking at that sort of model.
And I guess another interesting aspect of the Green New Deal is its name, the Green New Deal. And, you know, talking about where the New Deal in America came from in the 30s. And part of that was around the war effort. And one of the things about a war effort is that people kind of take on this collective responsibility, a personal responsibility, and whether policies are convenient or economically convenient or politically convenient fades into the background because you've got this huge overwhelming threat that you need to deal with, and it kind of reorders your priorities. And I guess the Green New Deal kind of tries to tell that story of realizing what a huge threat this is and reordering our national priorities. Does Britain have a story, I guess, in terms of how we could communicate it, but like what is our national story and what is our national answer to this threat?
We could look to history, and I've heard a few people in the last year or so talking about whether we need to demand the government puts itself on a war footing and forms a coalition government similar to what we had in World War II. I don't know if that is actually what we need to do practically, but also I'm not sure if looking to the past is a good idea. I mean, it can be very powerful in terms of your political rhetoric. I think the Green New Deal is a beautiful bit of policy. It's a nice soundbite. It's a nice way of, as I said earlier, about it's a connection about environmental policy, but also industrial policy. And I think calling it the Green New Deal does that work for it. So it's looking to a specific bit of history, which was talking about jobs. And I don't know if we have the same sort of equivalent. Other people have also talked about whether we should think of it as a bit like the National Health Service. Mm. It's something that we all love and British people get behind. Do we need a climate service? Except it wouldn't necessarily work like that because health is different from climate change. So I'm a bit worried about, and I think climate change is also different from war, and we should be really careful about thinking about climate change in terms of war. It's a different thing, and we're probably best served by thinking about climate change as its own issue and what it needs. So what we need in the 21st century, I mean, a big part of the problems of British politics in the last few decades has been how obsessed we are with the beginning and middle of the 20th century mm. and our slightly odd ideas of what that was. Mm. I think we should start looking forward rather than backward. It's tempting. I know when we're sort of looking and we're terrified about what the 2050s and 2080s might look like to do that, because I mean, I am terrified of what they look like. And it's sort of tempting to retreat into a particular idea of the past. But I think we'll be best if we manage to look forward, not backwards. I think we'll be limited if we try and mould whatever policy asks we want of the British government onto some kind of historical precedent.
Do you think we have the tools to move the political consensus in a way that, if not comparing it to past wars, is similar in terms of the abrupt shift in policy consensus? Do we have the tools to move the politicians, you know, that severely and that quickly in a way that will address climate change in the way it needs to be?
I think we have the tools. I don't know if we have the means. And I mean, it's hard to, we do need a very rapid shift. And I think it'll take a lot of different tactics to get there. I think the climate strikes are an example of how things can shift quite rapidly. I think the debate on plastics last year and the year before that were also an example of how things can shift quite rapidly and how environmental issues can make themselves into the mainstream and interrelate with all sorts of other social and cultural things. I mean, yeah, I think we sort of probably need the plastics debate times 20 about climate change. But I don't know what the tools are exactly. If I did, then we'd be doing it. But I am confident that we have, well, we either have the means. I'm confident that we can do it. I don't know if we will. It will take a lot. The reason why I'm hesitating on this is that it becomes very complicated when you start talking about what those tools and means might be, sure. because it has to be done on so many different fronts. If we're going to use a war metaphor, we have to be fighting on so many different fronts at the same time, and so many different identities and networks and individuals and communities have to be involved in so many different ways. I can see that happening. I mean, some people think about whether it'll be like a giant weather event is what will spur us into action. And occasionally climate activists sort of sit around and sort of imagine what might happen. And I remember reading a kid's book that was published about 20 years ago about massive floods hitting England, and then England bringing in sort of carbon rationing for the first time. And, you know, there's a sort of way you might imagine that it would be prompted by a big weather event. I'm not so sure that that would actually help us. I've got an old colleague from the University of Sussex who used to say, you know, people don't necessarily make the best decisions when they're scared. And I think, you know, if the country is flooded, if we're dealing with all sorts of other social and economic problems off the back of Brexit, I can't see us being in the, then I really can't see us having the means or the tools to be able to make the shifts that we need to.
So if hope is the best driver for this, what is a policy wish list that we can be hopeful for? In summary, what are these, you know, if people obviously want action on climate change, but we don't always know what that means as political activists because we're not closely engaged with it. What does that policy wish list look like in a general sense?
Well, we have to fight on a lot of different fronts. That also means a lot of different types of policy. Climate change has to weave its way through all sorts of different areas. Some easy wins to start off with, things that the government could do pretty soon, is we could start having extreme investment in the UK on energy efficiency. That would arguably boost our economy, and it seems a bit silly as to why we're not doing it. We need to lift the ban on onshore wind because, I mean, your listeners may not be aware of the fact that there is a ban on onshore wind in England. Every now and again, I say it to people and they look at me and yes, there is. It was one of those things that the Conservatives put in their manifesto when maybe they didn't think they were going to win, like some other things they might put in their manifesto. And they
couldn't think of what.
And, you know, I there's certainly appetite within the government to lift that ban. You can... I know there is. It's just whether they can get it through. And obviously people are distracted with other things. But those are some basic things that we could do. Britain has a lot of opportunity, could make a lot of its onshore wind capacity. And we should also have policies that support community energy. That's really vital if we're going to build the amount of renewable energy that we need in a way that is not going to make people feel alienated by it. Most people in the UK love onshore wind. It's a myth that they don't, but in the small places where they don't, it's, I think, a big part of it's because it's been forced upon them and they haven't been involved in it. So we need to see policies that really support the community groups that want to take ownership of their energy.
And how does a just transition, you mentioned that phrase earlier, how does that fit into that landscape?
So that's part of it, is community energy needs to be a big part of it. Another thing I was going to say in terms of adding things that we need to do is thinking about retraining. We also need to take a lot of money out of the oil and gas industry. So we've seen the divestment campaigns. There's a divest Parliament campaign to divest the pensions in Parliament. But more seriously, in terms of the money that runs through Westminster, we need to stop subsidising oil and gas in the way that we do. But that will lead to people losing their jobs. And so we need to ensure that they have other jobs and that we have decent retraining systems. There's a lot of opportunities for offshore oil and gas to transfer into offshore wind. We need to be making the most of those opportunities.
And where does your work at 1010 fit into this fight?
We are focused on engaging the public with action on climate change. So we appreciate that there's lots of, as I said, we've got to fight this on lots of different fronts, and the place that we specialise in is engaging the public. And we do that partly to unlock other areas, whether it's policy makers or industry, to also be interested, to see that the public is, let the public take a lead, and we'll know that other actors will follow. But it's also that they're important in their own right. So we do a lot of community energy work, or work with community energy groups. We've got a really exciting, I think our two most exciting projects we've got at the moment. One is our work on solar railways, which actually came out of a community group in the southeast of England in Sussex who wanted to build a community-owned solar farm. It's the village of Borkum, which are most famous for being the first anti-fracking protests about 6 years ago. And they came out of the anti-fracking protests quite bruised by that experience. And they wanted to do something positive. So they wanted to build community solar. And the way fracking had sort of divided the town and solar brought them together. It's a really, really lovely. Someone should make a movie about this story. It's lovely. Anyway, they were looking for places to plug their solar, community owned, locally owned solar farm in, but the grid was at capacity around there, so they couldn't find anywhere to plug it in. And then they noticed that the town is bisected by the railway, and they were it's an electric powered railway, and they looked at it and went, could we just plug our solar farm into the railways? And luckily an electrical engineer lived nearby, so they said, can we do this? And he answered with a load of engineering speak that only a few people understood. But basically the answer was ish. So we managed to put those two groups together, and we worked with them on a grant from Innovate UK and did a feasibility study. And basically, long story short, we should have some solar powered railways by the end of this year or early 2020. And they will be commuter owned solar farms that will be powering your trains. So your train, the train companies might be privatized, but the electricity it runs on will be run owned by the commuters. And so that's one of the most really exciting projects we're doing. We hope we also probably will be extending that to the electrification of the railways in South Wales, which could be wind powered. And again, I was saying, it's really important we involve communities in where we site large renewables, whether it's wind or solar. And particularly with wind, I think that will mean that those communities can think about where they want the wind that's going to be powering their trains to go. The other really cool thing we're doing is on heat decarbonisation. We're working with Hackney Council to look into the feasibility of putting heat pumps under parks. So anyone who lives near a park will probably know the problem of the park being closed for a bit because of a concert, because the park needs to make money. Or they'll notice that the opening hours are shifted, or different projects that used to happen in the park aren't happening because they've been cut. So it's a real challenge to think about how we're going to fund our parks. And this is a way to help us fund our parks, but also involve the public in decarbonisation at the same time. So heat pumps are a technology which, I don't know, have you ever seen a heat pump?
No.
Okay. I'd never seen a heat pump until my colleague was like, let's talk about heat pumps. And I was like, well, nurse this thing. And I asked some friends, and some of them that lived in the countryside were like, oh, I know a heat pump. So in the countryside, they're a bit more common because, well, you have heat pumps, they work a bit like a reverse fridge. In fact, they discovered a heat pump when someone just turned a fridge around and burnt themselves. But it kind of, it takes heat from either the air or water or the ground, and then makes more heat from it, which you can use to heat a whole home or sure. another building. In fact, there's a really cool project in Old Street, which is trying to take heat from the tube. So exciting.
Anyway, there's plenty on there.
Exactly. And it will also, this is so exciting. Anyway, the project that we're working with Hackney will take heat from the ground, and ground source heat pumps need quite a lot of space. So people will have them where they have space, but we don't have much space in the cities, but parks are space. So we can install the heat pumps under the park. The local groups that use the park could be involved in when we do it, how we do it, if we do it, learning what on earth a heat pump is in the process. Yeah. And then that gives a revenue stream for the parks. So we used to have this great project called Solar Schools, which kind of does what it says on the tin. It was schools getting involved, getting their communities involved to fundraise for solar. And loads of people in the community who couldn't install solar on their own roof for whatever reason could help install it in the school. This, we hope, will have could be a similar project, but have heat pumps and allow people an opportunity to engage with low carbon tech that otherwise they just read about in newspapers. Yeah. So we're really excited about that. And it's also a good example of how taking action on climate change can offer all sorts of other benefits. Mm. It'll, you know, potentially it'll keep community centres open in the parks. It'll have all sorts of other things.
Well, I wanted to ask about this because you mentioned earlier your background is in science communication. And for full disclosure, mine is as well. So we both have special interest in this subject. And many of our listeners might not know an awful lot about science communication or have experienced a lot of it. Is it political for you? Because it is for me, that the idea of science communication and empowering people. Is there, your work kind of seems like this overlap where science communication and politics and the interest in empowering people collides?
Well, climate change is one of those areas where it's quite obvious how engineering and science and policy and culture, people often forget the culture bit of this. They go, oh, it's politics and science. You're like, your culture's a big part of this too. And yeah, economics, all these things combine. But I think that's true of anything. I mean, science itself is, you know, it's political as to what gets funded, just because you're not necessarily looking at, you're not necessarily learning how a particular chemical reaction works through the lens of ideology, although people have in the past. That doesn't mean that there isn't politics that go on. There's micropolitics in the lab over who you're going to employ. You know, it's huge issues to do with diversity in science. Then there's political decisions that are made at places like Bayes about what we fund. So I don't feel that my work in climate change is necessarily more political. It is more obviously political,
sure,
but it's not necessarily any more political.
And just to finish off, And you mentioned earlier that you're going to try to stray away from negativity in this conversation, but obviously that was impossible. Without wanting our listeners and myself personally to become complacent about the idea that there are people fighting for climate change who do have hope that we'll get through this in one way or another, how do you stay hopeful personally doing this day in, day out?
The first thing to say is that most of the time I don't. It is quite a depressing issue.
I wasn't hoping that was the answer.
There is something that is kind of hopeful inherently about climate change, in that it's not a pass or fail issue. So it means that people sometimes talk about, we're going to solve climate change. Like, we are not going to solve climate change. That boat, that diesel powered boat, that like sailed a long time ago.
Sure.
We've already caused over a degree of climate change. And there's all sorts of reasons why it's very challenging to keep to 1.5 degrees even, let alone two. But because it happens by degree, by bit of degree, there's always hope. I mean, we are a long way for there being no hope. And there's also ways in which we can protect ourselves if we take more action. So we talk about taking action on climate change to stop it, and we need to do that. But we also, because we know we already had happened already, we need to think about what we can do to tackle the climate and protect ourselves from the climate change that has already happened. So we have hope in our ability to do those things. So there's something inherent about the fact that it's not a pass or fail. It's not, we mess that up and now we can't mop up that milk. Well, that messed up, but there's still another pint of milk over there. It's not half full or half empty. It sort of comes in different milliliters or so. I don't know. There's some kind of way I think about it. But there's that. And that does, I know I'm not the only person who finds hope in this sort of, like, even if there's a little chink at the end of the tunnel, it's still there. But then there's other things, like we have done amazing things, like invent solar power and discover it in the first place, because we could just be sitting around going, oh, it's a bit warm the other week, wasn't it? It's a bit rainy. Weather's a bit weird again. And we did notice it. So there is hope in the fact that we are clever enough to have noticed it. We are clever enough to have transformed our society to be as addicted to fossil fuels as it is. Like, that is something, there's something quite inspirational in the story of like, Shell is, I mean, amazing. Like, Shell is called Shell because it used to sell seashells.
Okay.
Like, there used to be an old man in the East End who sold shells, and that's why it's called Shell.
I did not know that.
And it's grown over since the 1850s into this incredible multinational that sucks oil and gas out of the ground and has incredible weird PR campaigns and gets pulled into human rights violation protests. Like, it's kind of incredible. It's awe-inspiring in the sort of old-fashioned idea of awe, where you're slightly terrified by it. But I think we should take inspiration from how much we've managed to transform our world as it is. It's terrifying and in some ways very, very depressing. But humans are powerful. That is something you can take from the climate story. And I think if you have some hope in humanity is not simply awful, which I understand if
difficult
some people,
nowadays. Yeah.
But if you have any hope in humanity, then I think there's hope in our ability to tackle climate change.
I didn't think we were going to find inspiration in oil companies, but I do like it. I guess the really hopeful thing about that is that there is a direct and strong correlation between how much work each one of us does on this issue and how much less bad the results of climate change will be, which is probably all the straws we can clutch for now. But Alice, thank you so much for coming in to speak to us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's all for today, folks. Join us on Tuesday for more Brexit banter and keep your eyes peeled for Henna's pod list updates, of course. And as always, subscribe, rate and review. Have a lovely weekend. You've been listening to the Progressive Britain podcast. The music was One in the West by Blue Dot Sessions, licensed under Creative Commons, and many thanks to our fantastic and long-suffering producer, Caroline Crampton.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.